Chapter 5. "You lead off," Pitt ordered Marquez. "We'll walk behind the beam of your miner's lamp until its batteries give out. Then we go the rest of the way on my dive light. Climbing to the upper levels through shafts will be the tough part," said the miner. "So far we've been lucky. Very few shafts had a ladder. Most of them used hoists to transport the miners and ore."
"We'll tackle that problem when we face it," said Pitt.
It was 5 o'clock in the afternoon when they set out through the tunnel, heading west as indicated on Pitt's dive compass. He looked odd, hiking through the tunnel in his dry suit, gloves, and service dive boots with steel toes. He carried only the computer, compass, underwater dive light, and the knife strapped to his right leg. He left the rest of his gear beside the dying embers of the fire. The tunnel was clear of debris, and the first 100 yards were fairly easy. Marquez led the way, followed by Pat and Ambrose, with Pitt bringing up the rear. There was enough walking room between the ore car tracks and the tunnel wall, making it unnecessary to step and stumble over the rail ties. They passed one shaft, then two, that were empty and lacking any means of climbing to the next level. They came to a small open gallery with 3 tunnels leading off into the darkness.
"If I remember the mine's layout correctly," said Marquez, "we take the tunnel that angles to the left."
Pitt consulted his trusty computer.
"Right on the money."
Another 50 yards, and they came to a rock fall. The amount of loose rock was not massive, and the men set to work, digging a crawl space. An hour of effort and a quart of sweat later, they had gouged an opening big enough for all to snake through. The tunnel led to another chamber, this one with a shaft leading to an old hoist that was still in place. Pitt shined his light into the vertical passage. It was like looking into a bottomless pit upside down. The top lay far out of the range of the beam. But this shaft looked promising. A maintenance ladder was gripping one wall, and the cables that once lowered and raised the lift cages were still hanging in place.
"This is as good as it gets," said Pitt.
"I hope the ladder is sound," said Ambrose, grabbing the vertical sides and giving it a shake. It trembled like a bow from the base up until it vanished in the darkness.
"My days of climbing hand over hand up old slimy cables are long gone."
"I'll go first," Pitt said, sliding a thong on the dive light's handle around his wrist.
"Mind the first step," Pat said with a faint smile.
Pitt looked into her eyes and saw genuine concern. "The last step is the one that worries me most."
He gripped the ladder, climbed several rungs, and hesitated, not happy about the wobble. He pressed on, keeping an eye on the hoist cables hanging only an arm's length away. If the ladder gave way, he could at least reach out and stop his fall with one of the cables. He ascended slowly, one rung at a time, testing each one before giving it his full weight. He could have moved much faster, but he had to be sure the others could safely follow him. 50 feet above the people watching him in rapt suspense, he stopped and beamed his light up the shaft. The ladder abruptly ended only 6 feet ahead of him, but 12 feet below the floor of the tunnel above. Climbing 2 more rungs, Pitt extended an arm and grasped one of the cables. The woven strands were 5/8 of an inch thick, ideal for a good grip. He released his hold on the ladder and hauled himself hand over hand up the cable until he was 4 feet above the level of the tunnel floor. Then he swayed back and forth in an arc, gaining a couple of feet with each sweep before finally jumping onto solid rock.
"How is it?" shouted Marquez.
"The ladder is broken off just below the tunnel, but I can pull you the rest of the way. Send up Dr. O'Connell." As Pat climbed toward Pitt's light, propped with its beam pointing down the shaft, she could hear him pounding something with a rock. By the time she reached the last rung, he had chiseled a pair of hand grips into some old timber and lowered it over the edge. "Grab hold of the center board with both hands and hold on.
She did as she was ordered without protest and was quickly dragged onto firm ground. Minutes later, Marquez and Ambrose were standing in the tunnel beside her. Pitt aimed his light up the tunnel as far as the beam could penetrate and saw that it was clear of rock falls. Then he switched it off to conserve the batteries.
After you, Marquez.
I probed this tunnel 3 years ago. If I remember correctly, it leads straight to the Pandora entrance shaft.
Can't get out that way because of the avalanche, said Ambrose.
We can bypass it, Pitt said, studying the monitor of the computer. If we take the next crosscut and go 150 yards, it meets a tunnel from a mine called the North Star.
What exactly is a crosscut? Asked Pat.
Access through perpendicular veins driven at right angles to a working tunnel. They're used for ventilation and communication between digging operations, answered Marquez. He looked at Pitt doubtfully.
I've never seen such a passage, which doesn't mean it doesn't exist, but it's probably filled in.
Then keep a sharp eye along the tunnel wall on your left, advised Pitt.
Marquez nodded silently and set off into the darkness, his miner's lamp lighting the way. The tunnel stretched on and seemed endless. At one point, Marquez stopped and asked Pitt to shine his stronger beam at a rock fill between the timbers.
This looks like what we're looking for, he said, pointing to a hard granite arch above the loose rock.
The men immediately went to work clearing the debris. After several minutes, they had dug through. Pitt leaned in and aimed his beam into a passage barely large enough to walk through. Then he checked his compass.
It heads in the right direction. Let's clear a crawl space and keep going.
This tunnel was narrower than the others, and they were forced to step over the ties supporting the ore cart tracks, making the going slow and torturous. An hour of endless walking over the tracks in the gloom, with only the miner's lamp for illumination, sapped what little stamina they had left. Everyone caught their feet on the uneven ties and stumbled one step for every five that was unimpeded. Another cave-in that could not be penetrated caused a seemingly endless detour that cost almost 2 hours. Finally, they were able to bypass through a shaft that sloped up three more levels before ending at a large gallery that contained the corroded remains of a steam hoist. They struggled up to the top and trudged past the great steam cylinders and reels still holding a mile of cable. The strain of the past few hours was beginning to show on Marquez. He was in good shape for his age, but he was not conditioned for the exertion and emotional stress he had endured the last several hours. Ambrose, though, looked as though he were on a walk in a park. He appeared remarkably calm and unruffled for a classroom professor. The only amusement came from Pitt's mumbled curses. At his 6'3", the hard hat, loaned to him by Pat because she was several inches shorter, struck overhead timbers with frustrating regularity. Trailing behind, Pitt could not see their faces in the dim and cavorting shadows, but he knew that each one of them possessed a stubbornness that would keep them going until they dropped, too proud to be the first to suggest a rest break. He noted that their breathing had become more labored. Though he still felt fresh, he began panting loudly so the others could hear his seemingly desperate plea.
I'm done in. How about stopping to rest a minute?
Sounds good to me, said Marquez, relieved that someone else had suggested it.
Ambrose leaned against one wall.
I say we keep going until we get out of here.
You won't get my vote, said Pat. My legs are screaming with agony. We must have stepped over 1,000 railroad ties.
It was only after they all sagged to the floor of the tunnel, while Pitt casually remained standing, that they knew they had been tricked. None of them complained, everyone happy to relax and massage sore ankles and knees.
Any idea how much farther? Asked Pat.
Pitt consulted his computer for the 100th time.
I can't be absolutely positive, but if we can climb 2 more levels and are not blocked by another cave-in, we should be out of here in another hour.
"Where do you reckon we'll come out?" asked Marquez.
"My guess is somewhere right under the main town of Telluride."
"That would be the old O'Reilly claim. It was a shaft sunk not far from where the gondola runs up the mountain to the ski slopes at Mountain Village. You do have a problem, though."
"Another one?"
"The new Sheridan Hotel and its restaurant now sit directly on top of the old mine entrance."
Pitt grinned. "If you're right, dinner is on me."
They went silent for the next 2 minutes, lost in their thoughts. The only sounds came from their breathing and the steady drip of moisture from the roof of the tunnel. Despondency gave way to hope. Knowing the end was perhaps in sight, their symptoms of fatigue began to wash away. Pitt had always suspected that women had more acute hearing than men from the times his various lady friends had visited his apartment and complained that the volume on his TV was too loud. His suspicions were confirmed when Pat said,
"I think I hear a motorcycle."
"A Harley-Davidson or a Honda?" asked Marquez, laughing for the first time since leaving his house.
"No, I'm serious," Pat said firmly. "I swear it sounds like a motorcycle."
Then Pitt heard something, too. He turned and faced the tunnel from the direction they had come and cupped his hands to his ears. He made out the undeniable sound of exhaust from a high-performance off-road motorcycle. He stared soberly at Marquez.
"Do the locals ride around old mine tunnels on motocross dirt bikes for a thrill?"
Marquez shook his head.
"Never.
They'd become lost in a maze of tunnels if they didn't plunge down a 1,000-foot shaft first. Then there's the danger of their exhaust noise causing rotted beams to collapse and a cave-in to crush them. No, sir, nobody I know is fool enough to joyride underground."
"Where did they come from?" Pat asked, no one in particular.
"From another mine that's still accessible. Lord only knows how they happen to be in the same tunnel as we are."
"A peculiar coincidence," Pitt said, staring up the tunnel. He felt a sense of uneasiness. Why? He couldn't be sure. He stood without moving a muscle, listening to the rattling sound of the exhaust as it grew louder. It was a foreign sound in the old mine labyrinth. It did not belong. He stood still as the first flash of light showed far down the tunnel. Pitt couldn't tell yet if it was one or more motorcycles coming through the tunnel. It seemed a reasonable assumption that he should treat the biker or bikers as a threat. Better safe than sorry. As ancient and hackneyed as the words sounded, they still had meaning, and his cautious nature had saved him on more than one occasion. He turned and slowly walked past Ambrose and Marquez. Absorbed in the approach of the sound and lights, they took no notice as he slipped along one wall of the tunnel in the direction of the approaching bikers. Only Pat focused on Pitt as he unobtrusively stole into the darkness of a portal leading into a narrow bore between the timbers. One moment he was there, the next he had vanished like a wraith. There were three bikers. The front of their machines were packed with an array of halogen lights that blinded the exhausted survivors, who shielded their eyes with their hands and turned away as the engine slowed and idled in neutral. Two of the intruders dismounted their bikes and walked closer, their bodies silhouetted by the bright lights behind them. They looked like space aliens in their black, sleek helmets and two-piece jerseys worn under chest protectors. Their boots came halfway to their knees, and their hands were encased in black, ribbed gloves. The third biker remained on his machine as the other two approached and raised the shields on their helmets.
"You don't know how happy we are to see you," said Pat excitedly.
"We sure could have used your help earlier," said Ambrose wearily. "My compliments on making it this far," said the figure on the right, in a voice deep and sinister. "We thought sure you'd drowned in the Amini's chamber."
"Amini's?" Pat repeated, puzzled.
"Where did you guys come from?" demanded Marquez.
"It doesn't matter," said the biker, as if he were brushing off a classroom student's irrational question.
You knew we were trapped in the chamber by a rockfall and rising water?
Yes, the biker said coldly.
And you did nothing? Marquez said incredulously. You didn't try to rescue us or go for help?
No.
A stimulating conversationalist, this guy, thought Pitt. If he'd been a tiny bit suspicious earlier, he was downright convinced now that these men were not local daredevils on a weekend adventure. These men were killers, and heavily armed. He didn't know why, but he knew they were not going to allow them to escape the mines alive. It was time to act, and surprise was his only advantage. He slipped his dive knife from its sheath and gripped the hilt. It was the only weapon he had, and it would have to do. He took several slow, deep breaths and gave a final flex to his fingers. It was now or never.
We came within minutes of drowning in the chamber, said Pat, wondering what Pitt was planning, if anything. She began to wonder if he was a coward and simply hiding from danger.
We know. That was the plan.
Plan? What plan?
You all were supposed to die, the biker said conversationally.
The words were greeted with a stunned, uncomprehending silence.
Unfortunately, your will to survive overcame the cave-in and the flooding, the biker continued. We did not foresee your perseverance. But it is of no matter. You merely prolonged the inevitable.
The dynamite blast, muttered Marquez in shock. That was you?
The answer was candid.
Yes, we set the charge.
Pat began to look like a deer staring into the headlights of an approaching truck. She knew that the bikers were not aware of Pitt's presence, so she acted as if he didn't exist. Marquez and Ambrose assumed he was simply standing behind them quietly, as stunned with shock as they were.
Why would you want to kill us? She asked, her voice shaking. Why would total strangers want to murder us?
You saw the skull, and you saw the inscriptions.
Marquez looked like a man torn between fear and anger.
So what? He growled.
Your discovery cannot be allowed to become known outside these mines.
We've done nothing wrong, Ambrose said, strangely calm.
We're scientists studying historic phenomena. We're not talking treasure, but ancient artifacts. It's insane to be killed because of it.
The biker shrugged.
It's unfortunate, but you became involved with matters far beyond your comprehension.
How could you possibly know about our entry into the chamber? Asked Marquez.
We were informed. That's all you need to know.
By who?
Not more than 5 people knew we were there.
We're wasting time, grunted the second biker. Let's finish our business and throw them down the nearest shaft.
This is madness, muttered Ambrose, with little or no feeling in his voice.
Pitt silently moved from the bore, any sounds of his footsteps covered by the soft popping from the exhaust, and crept up behind the rider still sitting on his bike, who was distracted by the conversation. Pitt was no stranger to killing, but it wasn't in him to knife another man in the back, no matter how rotten the victim might be. In the same motion, he reversed the grip on the knife and plunged the blunt hilt with all his strength against the base of the biker's neck below the helmet. It bordered on a killing blow, but it was a pound short of fatal. The biker sagged in his seat and fell back against Pitt without making so much as a soft moan. Pitt crouched low and quickly threw his arms around the body, held it for a moment, then lowered it, together with the bike, quietly onto the ore cart track with the engine still idling in neutral. Working swiftly, he pushed aside the biker's chest protector and uncased a para-ordnance 10-plus-1 round 45-caliber automatic from a shoulder holster strapped under an armpit. He trained the sights on the back of the biker standing on his right and pulled back the hammer. He had never fired a P-10 before, but from the feel he knew the magazine was full and that the gun possessed most of the same features as his trusty old Colt 45,
which was locked inside the Numa vehicle he'd driven to Colorado from Washington. The headlights on the motorcycles brightly illuminated the two killers, who failed to detect the figure stealing up behind them. But as Pitt crept closer, he passed in front of the light from the third bike, which was lying on the track, and he became identifiable to Ambrose. The anthropologist spied Pitt emerging from the bright light, pointed behind the bikers, and blurted, "How did you get back there?" At the words, Pitt took careful aim and allowed his index finger to caress the trigger.
"Who are you talking to?" the first biker demanded.
"Little old me," Pitt said casually. These men were top of the line in their profession. There was no hint of stunned surprise, no pointless discussion, no obvious questions, no hesitation or remote display of uncertainty. Their sixth sense worked as one. Their actions came with lightning speed. In a seemingly fused, well-practiced movement, they jerked the P-10 autos from their holsters and whirled around within a single second, the expressions on their faces frozen in cold implacability. Pitt did not face the killers full-on, knees slightly bent, his gun gripped and extended in two hands directly in front of his nose, the way they taught in police academies or as seen in action movies. He preferred the classic stance, body turned sideways, eyes staring over one shoulder, gun stretched out in one hand. Not only did he present less of a target, but his aim was more precise. He knew that the gunslingers of the West who'd lived to a ripe old age had not necessarily been the fastest on the draw, but they were the straightest shooters, who'd taken their time to aim before pulling the trigger. Pitt's first shot took the biker on the right in the nape of his neck. A slight, almost infinitesimal shift of the P-10 as he squeezed the trigger for the second time, and the biker on the left took a bullet in the chest. At nearly the same instant, his own gun was lining up on Pitt's silhouetted figure. Pitt could not believe that two men could react as one in the blink of an eye. Had they been given another 2 seconds to snap off a shot, it would have been Pitt whose body fell heavily across the granite floor of the mine tunnel. The gunshots erupted like a deafening barrage of artillery fire, reverberating throughout the rock walls of the tunnel. For 10 seconds, perhaps 20, it seemed more like an hour, Pat, Ambrose, and Marquez stared unbelievingly at the dead bodies at their feet, eyes wide and glazed. Then the tentative beginnings of a dazed hope and the final realization that they were still alive broke the horror-numbed spell.
"What in God's name is going on?" Pat said, her voice low and vague. Then she looked up at Pitt. "You killed them." It was more a statement than a question.
"Better them than you," Pitt said, putting his arm around her shoulders. "We've experienced a nasty nightmare, but it's almost over now." Marquez stepped past the rails and leaned down over the dead killers.
"Who are these people?"
"A mystery for law enforcement authorities to solve," replied Ambrose. He thrust out a hand. "I'd like to shake your hand, Mr.—" He paused and looked blank. "I don't even know the name of the man who saved my life."
"It's Dirk Pitt," said Pat.
"I'm deeply in your debt," said Ambrose. He seemed more agitated than relieved.
"As am I," added Marquez, slapping Pitt's back.
"What mine do you think they entered to get here?" Pitt asked Marquez.
The miner thought a moment.
"Most likely the Pandora."
"Well, that means they purposely trapped themselves when they blew the dynamite that caused the avalanche," said Ambrose.
Pitt shook his head.
"Not purposely. They knew they could make their way back to the surface by another route. Their big mistake was in using too massive a charge. They hadn't planned on the earth tremors, the collapse of the tunnel, and the opening of the underground fissures that allowed the water to rise and flood the tunnel."
"It figures," agreed Marquez. "Since they were on the opposite side of the cave-in, they could have easily ridden their bikes up the sloping shaft ahead of the flooding to the entrance. Finding it blocked with snow, they began searching connecting tunnels for a way out.
And after riding lost through the mines for hours, eventually came upon us," finished Ambrose.
Pitt nodded. By riding up the Pandora's entrance shaft to this level, they saved climbing the vertical shafts we were forced to struggle through.
It's almost as if they were looking for us, Marquez murmured.
Pitt didn't voice his thoughts to the others, but he was certain that once the bikers had ridden to the upper levels to escape the flooding, they had then followed in the footsteps of the four of them.
It's all so crazy, said Pat,
staring dazedly at the dead bikers.
What did he mean? We were involved with matters far beyond our comprehension.
Pitt shrugged. That's for others to decide. The question in my mind is who sent them? Who do they represent? Beyond that, I'm only a marine engineer who is damp and cold and wants to find a thick Colorado prime rib medium rare and a glass of tequila.
For a marine engineer, said Ambrose, grinning, you're pretty handy with a gun.
It doesn't take virtuosity to shoot a man from behind, Pitt came back cynically.
What do we do with him? Inquired Marquez, pointing at the biker Pitt had clubbed senseless.
We've no rope to tie him up, so we'll take his boots. He won't get far in bare feet through the mine tunnels.
You want to leave him?
No sense in hauling an inert body around. Chances are by the time we notify the sheriff and he sends his deputies down here, the killer will still be unconscious.
Then Pitt paused and asked, Have any of you ridden motorcycles?
I rode a Harley for 10 years, answered Marquez.
And I have an old Honda CBX Supersport that belonged to my dad, Pat volunteered.
Do you ride it?
Rode it all through college. I still hit the roads with it on weekends.
Pitt looked at Pat with newfound respect.
So you're an old leather crotch, hard-in-the-saddle woman.
You got it, she said proudly.
Then he turned to Ambrose.
And you, Doc?
Never sat on a motorcycle in my life.
Why do you ask?
Because we've got what look like 3 perfectly good Suzuki RM125 Supercross bikes, and I see no reason why we can't borrow them and ride out of the mine.
Marquez's teeth showed in a wide smile.
I'm with you.
I'll wait here until the sheriff shows up, said Ambrose. The rest of you get going. I don't want to spend any more time with a live killer and 2 dead men than I have to.
I don't like leaving you here alone with this killer, Doc. I'd prefer that you ride behind me until we're out of here.
Ambrose was firm.
Those bikes don't look like they were meant to haul passengers. I'm damned if I'll ride on one. Besides, you'll be traveling over rail tracks, making it unstable as hell.
Have it your way, said Pitt, giving in to the obstinate anthropologist.
Pitt crouched and removed the P-10 automatics from the bodies. He was anything but a born killer, but he showed little remorse. Only a minute earlier, these men had been intent on murdering 3 innocent people whom they had never met, an act he could never have allowed to happen under any circumstances. He handed one of the guns to Ambrose.
Stay at least 20 feet away from our friend and stay alert if he so much as blinks.
Pitt also gave Ambrose his dive light. The batteries should last until the sheriff comes.
I doubt if I could bring myself to shoot another human, Ambrose protested,
but his voice came with a cold edge.
Don't look upon these guys as human. They're cold-blooded executioners who could slit a woman's throat and eat ice cream afterward. I warn you, Doc, if he looks cross-eyed at you, brain him with a rock.
The Suzukis were still idling in neutral, and it took them less than a minute to figure out the shift, brake, and throttle controls. With a farewell wave to Ambrose, Pitt roared off first. There was no room for the machines to move between the outer rails and the walls of the tunnel, not without scraping the hand grips on the rough granite. Pitt kept his wheels in the center of the rail tracks, closely followed by Pat and Marquez. Bouncing over the rail ties with rigid suspensions rattled their teeth and made for uncomfortable riding. Pat felt as if her insides were being shaken around by a laundromat dryer. Pitt found the trick was to find the proper speed that gave the least vibration. It worked out to 25 miles an hour,
a speed that might have seemed slow and safe on a paved road, but was quite dangerous inside a narrow mine tunnel. The hard rock acoustics made the exhaust blast echo in their ears. The beams from the headlights hopped up and down, striking the rails and overhead timbers like strobe lights. He narrowly missed an ore car that was sitting on the tracks and partially protruding from an intersecting tunnel. After riding up the gentle grade of a lift shaft, they reached the upper level to a mine that was labeled the Citizen on Pitt's directional computer. Pitt rolled to a stop where the tunnel met another at a fork and consulted the tiny monitor. "Are we lost?" Pat queried above the rattle from the exhaust pipes. "Another 200 yards down the tunnel on the left, and we should come to the end of the mine tunnel you said comes out under the new Sheridan Hotel." "The entrance to the O'Reilly claim was covered over 100 years ago, said Marquez. "We'll never get out that way." "Never hurts to look," said Pitt, shifting gears and easing the clutch on the Suzuki. He gave the bike a burst of speed and was forced to brake hard within 2 minutes, when he suddenly confronted a brick wall that solidly blocked the old mine entrance. He came to an abrupt stop, leaned the bike against a timber, and studied the bricks under the headlight. "We'll have to find another way," said Marquez, as he pulled alongside, came to a stop, and set both feet on the ground to keep the bike upright. "We've come out at the basement foundation wall of the hotel." Pitt appeared not to have heard him. As if his mind was 1,000 miles away, he slowly reached out and ran his hand over the old kiln-dried red bricks. He turned as Pat stopped her bike and turned off the ignition. "Where do we go now?" she asked, her voice betraying near total exhaustion. Pitt spoke without turning. "There," he answered offhandedly, pointing in the general direction of the brick wall. "I suggest you both move your bikes to the side of the tunnel." Pat and Marquez didn't get it. They still didn't get it after Pitt climbed on the Suzuki, revved up the engine, and spun gravel under the rear wheel as he rode back into the tunnel. After a short minute, he was heard accelerating down the tracks toward them, the Suzuki's headlight beam dancing madly off the timbers. Marquez reckoned Pitt was doing nearly 30 miles an hour when he thrust out his legs and dug his heels onto the twin ore cart rails less than 10 yards from the wall, released his grip on the hand controls, and stood up, allowing the Suzuki to speed on from under him. Slumped backward to compensate for his momentum, he actually remained upright for nearly 20 feet before his feet slipped off the rails and he folded into a ball before tumbling through the tunnel like a soccer ball. The motorcycle stayed on its wheels, but was just starting to lie on its side when it crashed into the brick wall with a protesting screech of metal and a cloud of dust before bursting through the old decaying bricks and vanishing into the void beyond. Pat ran over to Pitt's body, which had skidded to a stop and was sprawled on the ground. She would have sworn he had killed himself, but he looked up at her, blood streaming from a gash on his chin, and grinned like a madman. "Let's see Evel Knievel try that one," he said. Pat stared down at him in amazement. "I can't believe you didn't break every bone in your body." "None broken," he muttered in pain, as he slowly rose to his feet. "But I think I bent a few." "That was the craziest thing I ever saw," mumbled Marquez. "Maybe, but it worked better than I expected." Pitt, clutching his right shoulder, nodded at the hole in the brick wall. He stood there, getting his breath and waiting for the pain from bruised ribs and a dislocated shoulder to ease, while Marquez began pulling away the bricks loosened by the bike's passage to enlarge the entry. The miner peered around the fractured wall and aimed his miner's lamp inside. After a few seconds, he looked back and said, "I think we're in deep trouble." "Why?" asked Pat. "Can't we get out that way?" "We can get out," said Marquez, "but it's going to cost us big time."
"Cost?"
Pitt limped painfully to the opening and peered inside. "Oh, no," he groaned.
"What is it?"
Pat demanded in exasperation. "The motorcycle," said Pitt. "It crashed into the wine cellar of the hotel restaurant.
There must be 100 broken bottles of vintage wine flowing down a drain in the floor.